The other day when I went to visit Eugene Auville in the hospital, I found that he was on the same floor as the maternity ward, which I had to pass by, and that brought back memories of the birth of each of our three boys. When Becky got pregnant the first time, and I'm sure you can identify with this, we read everything we could about what happens in those 9 months in the womb. And of course we knew what all the signs were of birth coming on. But it's sort of funny now looking back on it, because none of the three births really came about in textbook fashion. With the first, Becky's water didn't break. They did that in the hospital. And then with the second, we thought her water broke. We went into the hospital and they said, no, it hasn't broken, but we're going to be kind to you. You're so close to your due date. We're going to induce labor. Thank you very much. And then on the third one, it wasn't like the first two at all, because Joshua was delivered by C-section. Well, in Matthew 24, verse 8, part of the passage we're about to read, Jesus compares the signs of the end of the age to birth pangs. However, I think many people over the course of the last 2,000 years have misread these signs, just as we as new parents misread the signs of birth. The key verse in the chapter we're about to read is verse 34. Jesus says, I tell you the truth, this generation will certainly not pass away until all these things have happened. Jesus gives us a number of signs of the end of the age in this passage, but I don't think he's talking about the end of world history, nor do I think he's talking about the second coming. According to verse 34, Jesus was talking about things which were to happen within a generation of his words being uttered. And he was correct in his prophecy. So let's read Matthew 24 together and see what Jesus is talking about. Hear the word of God. Jesus left the temple and was walking away when his disciples came up to him to call his attention to its buildings. Do you see all these things? He asked. I tell you the truth, not one stone here will be left on another. Everyone will be thrown down. As Jesus was sitting on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately. Tell us, they said, when will this happen, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? Jesus answered, watch out that no one deceives you. For many will come in my name claiming I am the Christ and will deceive many. You will hear of wars and rumors of wars, but see to it that you are not alarmed. Such things must happen, but the end is still to come. Nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines and earthquakes in various places. All these are the beginning of birth pains. Then you will be handed over to be persecuted and put to death, and you will be hated by all nations because of me. At that time, many will turn away from the faith and will betray and hate each other. And many false prophets will appear and deceive many people. Because of the increase of wickedness, the love of most will grow cold. But he who stands firm to the end will be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come. So, when you see standing in the holy place the abomination that causes desolation, spoken of through the prophet Daniel, let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let no one on the roof of his house go down to take anything out of the house. Let no one in the field go back to get his cloak. How dreadful it will be in those days for pregnant women and nursing mothers. Pray that your flight will not take place in winter or on the Sabbath. For then there will be great distress, unequaled from the beginning of the world until now, and never to be equaled again. If those days had not been cut short, no one would survive. But for the sake of the elect, those days will be shortened. At that time, if anyone says to you, look, here is the Christ, or there he is, do not believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will appear and perform great signs and miracles to deceive even the elect, if it were possible. See, I have told you ahead of time. So if anyone tells you, there he is out in the desert, do not go out. Or here he is in the inner rooms, do not believe it. For as lightning that comes from the east is visible even in the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. Wherever there is a carcass, there the vultures will gather. Immediately after the distress of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from the sky and the heavenly bodies will be shaken. At that time, the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky and all the nations of the earth will mourn. They will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. And He will send His angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather His elect from the four winds, from one end of the heavens to the other. Now learn this lesson from the fig tree. As soon as its twigs get tender and its leaves come out, you know that summer is near. Even so, when you see all these things, you know that it is near, right at the door. I tell you the truth, this generation will not, certainly not pass away until all these things have happened. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will never pass away. No one knows about that day or hour, not even the angels in heaven nor the Son, but only the Father. As it was in the days of Noah, so it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. For in the days before the flood, people were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, up to the day Noah entered the ark. And they knew nothing about what would happen until the flood came and took them all away. That is how it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. Two men will be in the field, one will be taken and the other left. Two women will be grinding with a handmill, one will be taken and the other left. Therefore keep watch, because you do not know on what day your Lord will come. But understand this, if the owner of the house had known at what time of night the thief was coming, he would have kept watch and would not have let his house be broken into. So you also must be ready, because the Son of Man will come at an hour when you do not expect Him. Who then is the faithful and wise servant, whom the master has put in charge of the servants in his household to give them their food at the proper time? It will be good for that servant whose master finds him doing so when he returns. I tell you the truth, he will put him in charge of all his possessions. But suppose that servant is wicked and says to himself, "My master is staying away a long time," and he then begins to beat his fellow servants and to eat and drink with drunkards. The master of that servant will come on a day when he does not expect him, and at an hour he is not aware of. He will cut him to pieces and assign him a place with the hypocrites, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. May God add His blessing to the reading and the preaching of His word. First thing we need to note about this passage is the setting. Jesus' discourse about the signs of the end of the age takes place as He's leaving the temple for the last time in the last week of His earthly life. His disciples comment on the beauty of the temple, and indeed it was one of the most beautiful buildings in the ancient world. This comment leads Jesus to tell them specifically what He had already hinted at. The temple is going to be destroyed, not one stone left on another. After leaving the temple precincts, Jesus goes out through the beautiful gate through which He had come into the city on Palm Sunday. He goes out to the Mount of Olives and He sits down, which was the typical posture for a rabbi when he was teaching. Unlike preachers today who stand to preach, rabbis would sit down to teach. And in fact, this corresponds exactly to what we have in Matthew 5 when He gives the Sermon on the Mount. He sits down on the mountain. Remember, Matthew is this perfectionist who's arranging everything just so, you know, a candlestick on each side of the mantelpiece. He's doing that here again. Jesus sits down with the first sermon and gives it on a mountaintop, and this is His last sermon, and He's sitting down on the mountaintop to give it to His disciples. And the disciples understandably ask Jesus about when the temple will be destroyed and what will be the sign of His coming and the end of the age. Now that word for coming is an interesting one in the New Testament. It's the word parousia. And it was the word used within the Greek-speaking Roman Empire to refer to a state visit by the emperor. We have state visits in our household. It's whenever the in-laws come to visit and we go through the house and we, you know, clean up everything and make it all look sparkling and new. This was also a word used to describe when a god or goddess would do something dramatic, like a miracle. Now what the disciples had in mind was something like this. They longed to see Jesus truly ruling as king. And remember, they haven't taken it in, what He's told them about dying on a cross in Jerusalem. So they long to see him ruling as king. They think that now may be the moment. And they probably already in their minds identify Jesus ruling as king with the destruction of the temple. Why do I say that? Because Jesus had already said and done things during his 3-year ministry that indicate that he believed he was the center of God's healing and restoring work, not the temple. So the disciples saw the coming of Jesus as king, the destruction of the temple, the ushering in of God's new age, as three things that would go together. And Jesus agrees with the disciples up to a point. The destruction of the temple is indeed going to be a sign of his vindication, for after all, he's prophesied it. So when it happens, they can look back and say, "Told you so. Jesus said this was going to happen." It will also be a sign of the new age of the church being ushered in, because there's not going to be any need for the temple. There's going to be no more need for sacrifice because of Jesus' sacrifice once for all on the cross. He warns them of wars and rumors of wars that are to come. There's going to be famines and earthquakes in various places. All of this took place in the first century. And he says these are just the beginning of birth pangs. After all this will come a time of persecution for the disciples. The first century was a great time of persecution for the new found Christian religion. In the midst of all of this, in the midst of false prophets and apostasy and the love of many growing cold, the disciples must stand firm. That's what Jesus' message is to them in the midst of this. They must stay on the job and take the gospel to all the nations. All of this is Jesus' prediction of what would happen within that generation. And it happened. In AD 68, Emperor Nero died. He was followed by no less than 4 contestants for the office of emperor, fighting for control. The Roman Empire itself and the great Pax Romana, the Roman peace, was teetering on the brink of destruction. During that same period of time, Rome laid siege to Jerusalem. For 4 years, many in Jerusalem died of starvation. There you have the famine that Jesus predicted. Some parents were even reduced to cannibalism. It was that bad. And then in AD 70, the Romans finally stormed the city. The Roman Jewish historian Josephus was there. He witnessed it. He tells us what happened. Over 1 million Jews were killed in the final conflict. 97,000 were taken captive. Now do you understand why Jesus said there was no conflict quite like this one from the beginning of the world to that time? Certainly there had not been anything like it for the Jewish people. The Romans, on the other hand, were so happy over what they thought was a solution to the Jewish problem that they erected an arch in Rome in honor of the conquering general Titus. This destruction of Jerusalem and all that went with it was what Jesus was predicting in this passage, all in response to the disciples' question. But Jesus goes on and he talks about the abomination that causes desolation. What was this all about? Well, the abomination that causes desolation was spoken of by the prophet Daniel. And Daniel's prophecy was fulfilled the first time in 170 BC when Antiochus Epiphanes, who we've talked about before, because Judas Maccabeus was the great Jewish conqueror who won out over Antiochus. Remember when we talked about the celebration of Hanukkah? We talked about Judas Maccabeus riding into Jerusalem the same way Jesus did. Okay, we're back to that same king. Antiochus Epiphanes, the king of Syria, had captured Jerusalem and he set up an altar to Zeus in the temple and he sacrificed a pig on it. Now do you understand why Judas Maccabeus needed to cleanse the temple afterwards? That was the first fulfillment of Daniel's prophecy. But Jesus predicts that something like it is going to happen again. And it almost happened in AD 40. When the Roman Emperor Gaius Caligula tried to set up a statue of himself in the Jewish temple. However, he was assassinated before he could carry out his plan. 30 years later, during the Jewish War, the Romans surrounded the temple and they placed their blasphemous standards within its precincts. That was the fulfillment of what Jesus prophesied. The legionary standards had eagles on them. Such a sight surrounding the temple would have been viewed by the Jews as graven images of worship. In fact, verse 28 about the vultures gathering may refer to these eagle standards, because the word can mean either vultures or eagles. Jesus gave this as a sign to His followers. When they would see this abomination that causes desolation, they would know the time had come to flee Jerusalem. Why is He so intent on this? Because He knew they would be tempted to stay and defend the city. And He knew what would happen to them. Starvation, eventually death. Do you know what happened to those who hid out on the mountaintop plateau of Masada, where Herod had built a great palace down by the Dead Sea? The Jews rushed there after the destruction of Jerusalem. They held out there for quite a long time until the Romans built a siege ramp going up to it and finally were able to breach the walls. And do you know what the Romans found when they got inside? All of the Jews had committed suicide. Jesus didn't want His disciples following that pattern. And so He warns them. He warns them also about would-be messiahs coming along. He says, look, when I come again, it's going to be evident to all, just like lightning. Some people say, well, I can understand how part of Matthew 24 refers to the destruction of Jerusalem, but surely the sun being darkened and all of that refers to the end times. Actually, the quotation about the sun being darkened and the moon not giving its light and the stars falling from the sky, it's a quotation from Isaiah. And to people living in Jesus' time, this was well-known, coded sort of language used to refer to huge social and political upheaval. The kind of upheaval that took place in the Roman Empire when Nero died in AD 68. And the kind of upheaval that happened when the Romans came in and leveled Jerusalem. But what about the sign of the Son of Man in the sky and His coming on the clouds of heaven? Surely that refers to the second coming. Well, this is a reference once again back to the book of Daniel. And interestingly enough, in Daniel, the coming of the Son of Man on the clouds of heaven refers to an upward, not a downward movement. So in other words, not a downward movement, not Jesus coming on the clouds of heaven back to earth, the second coming, but an upward movement. What's Jesus talking about here? His resurrection and ascension. In fact, in this passage, He gives three signs of His vindication. Yes, He's going to die on a cross, but He's going to be raised. He's going to ascend to heaven. The temple is going to be destroyed because there's going to be no more need for it. And the good news of Jesus' victory is going to be spread to the four corners of the known world. In fact, verse 31, where it talks about the angels going out to gather the elect, that word for angels is literally the word messengers. Jesus there is talking about His messengers, the disciples, going out throughout the whole known world to spread the good news of the gospel and thereby gathering the elect into the kingdom. All of this, Jesus speaks to His disciples in the first century so that they'll know when these things happen, cataclysmic things, that He is really sovereign. Because He predicted it all. None of it's a surprise. And when they see this begin to happen, they need to remain steady. They need to keep on preaching about His victory. They'll be assured that they're on the right track because Jesus predicted it all ahead of time. Jesus goes on to warn them that nobody knows the day or hour when this is going to happen, when the temple is going to be destroyed. Normal life will seemingly continue right up to the last moment. Just as people were caught out by the flood in the story of Noah, so it will be when the destruction of Jerusalem comes. Then He says two men will be working in a field, one will be taken and another left. This is a reference to literally what happened when the Roman armies came in. They'd take some people off to death and they'd leave others inexplicably. And then Jesus tells a little parable. In order to remind the disciples of how they should live as this tribulation approaches. And the meaning of the parable is this. Jesus is going away, but He's leaving the disciples with work to do, the preaching of the gospel. And the point of the parable is that they should continue on with their work, regardless of the tumult going on in society. So I can hear the question you may be asking. What is the message for us in all of this? If Jesus was directing these words to His disciples, primarily in the first century, what's the message for us? Well, I don't think Jesus is talking about the second coming here. I think the passage has application to that. I don't want you to go home and think, gosh, the preacher doesn't believe in the second coming. Don't we confess that every Sunday in the Apostles' Creed? Well, yes, I believe it. I just don't believe this passage is talking about it. There's other passages in the New Testament that talk about it. But I think this passage has application to us. As we do await Jesus' parousia, His second coming. And the application is this. We need to go on preaching the gospel. Just as disciples did in the first century, there are still people groups in the world today that do not have the Bible in their own language. We need to support groups like Wycliffe Translators who are madly working at trying to translate the Bible into every known language. We need to support missionaries that are taking the gospel throughout the world. And even though we may not be able to go to the other side of the world, that doesn't excuse us from crossing the street to share the gospel with our neighbors. That's the big work we need to do, but the Lord has given us also many little things to do, hasn't He? Whatever work the Lord's given us to do, raising families, working farms, teaching in school, whatever we do, we need to do well to His glory. And if we're doing that, we'll be ready when He comes. We'll be ready for judgment. I really appreciate what C.S. Lewis once wrote about this subject. He said this, "How can characters in a play guess the plot?" I guess I can relate to this because I was a drama major in college. He says, "We're not the playwright. We are not the producer. We are not even the audience. We are on the stage. To play well the scenes in which we are on concerns us much more than to guess about the scenes that follow it." And then he gives an example from Shakespeare's King Lear. He says, "In King Lear, there is a man who is such a minor character that Shakespeare has not given him even a name. He is merely first servant. All the characters around him, Regan, Cornwall, and Edmund, have fine long-term plans. They think they know how the story is going to end, and they are quite wrong. The servant has no such delusions. He has no notion how the play is going to go, but he understands the present scene. He sees an abomination, the blinding of old Gloucester, take place, and he will not stand it. His sword is out and pointed at his master's breast in a moment. Then Regan stabs him dead from behind." That's the whole part. 8 lines all told. But, Lewis says, if it were real life and not a play, that is the part that would be best to have played. And then he makes this application. He says, "The doctrine of the second coming teaches us that we do not and cannot know when the world drama will end. The curtain may be rung down at any moment, say before you have finished reading this paragraph or before I finish preaching this sermon." This seems to some people intolerably frustrating. So many things would be interrupted. Perhaps you were going to get married next month. Perhaps you are going to get a raise next week. You may be on the verge of a great scientific discovery. You may be maturing great social and political reform. Surely no good and wise God would be so very unreasonable as to cut all of this short. Not now of all moments. But we think thus, Lewis says, because we keep on assuming that we know the play. We do not know the play. We do not even know whether we are in Act 1 or Act 5. We do not know who are the major and who the minor characters. The author knows. The audience, if there is an audience, if angels and archangels and all the company of heaven fill the pit and the stalls, they may have an inkling. But we, never seeing the play from outside, never meeting any characters except the tiny minority who are on in the same scenes as ourselves, wholly ignorant of the future and very imperfectly informed about the past, we cannot tell at what moment the end ought to come. That it will come when it ought, we may be sure. But we waste our time in guessing when that will be. That it has a meaning, we may be sure, but we cannot see it. When it is over, we may be told. We are led to expect that the author will have something to say to each of us on the part that each of us has played. The playing it well is what matters infinitely. Let's pray together. Father, we thank you for these words of Jesus, these true words that were fulfilled in the first century, these words of warning but also of comfort to his disciples. And we thank you for the application that there is for us in this, because there is still a task to be done, the preaching of the gospel to all the world. Lord, help us to be faithful in that task with the gifts that you've given us. Lord, whether it's supporting missionaries or those who translate the Bible or the Gideons who get the Bible to so many people around the world, or whether it's sharing with our neighbor the good news of Jesus' death on the cross for sins and resurrection from the dead. Lord, help us to be faithful in that great task, but also in the little tasks of every day, raising our families, teaching school, going to work, whatever it is we do, Lord, help us to do it well, to your glory. Help us to play our part well, to your honor. For we ask it in your name. Amen.